From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The annual release of the state budget is normally about as joyful an event as Jim Harbaugh's press conference will be if the 49ers lose to the Packers. But at Governor Brown's budget briefing yesterday, there was no doom and gloom. After a decade of huge budget gaps, the state enters 2013 in much better shape. Not that the Brown budget is loaded with largesse, but the budget does contain more money for education and health care, along with some major policy proposals. All about the Brown budget and what it would mean for California. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. It's not often you begin a program by focusing on a single sentence, but consider this from Governor Jerry Brown's new budget proposal released yesterday. Quote, "The state's budget is projected to remain balanced for the foreseeable future," unquote. There's a lot more to be said about the budget, of course, particularly when it comes to education and health care. But let's begin our review of the budget this morning with that remarkable assertion. The state's budget is projected to remain balanced for the foreseeable future. Joining us for a review of the governor's budget today, Jill Tucker, education writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Jill, good morning.
Good morning.
Lisa Alaferis is here as well. She's health editor for KQED News, and she edits the State of Health blog. Lisa, good morning.
Good morning.
And from Sacramento, John Myers, political editor for KXTV in Sacramento. Still seems funny to say that. And, of course, our former Sacramento bureau chief for KQED News. John, good morning.
Thanks, David. Good morning.
So, John, give us your take on this, which just seems so striking after the last decade or so to be able to say that sentence, that the budget is projected to remain balanced. What do you make of that?
Well, I found it very striking, too, and it was actually a surprise for me because the nonpartisan legislative analyst in November had estimated about a $2 billion problem. Now, we can talk about why the two numbers came up different. Some of it's timing, some of it is assumptions. But yeah, to see a balanced budget was striking. Arnold Schwarzenegger did that once in 2006, 2007. Of course, that was a little bit more optimistic thinking than even Brown's. But I think if you peel down, and it is a powerful sentence, Dave, but if you peel down one more layer, the real reason that the governor is able to say that is Proposition 30. Those taxes were a major part of this proposal. I was doing some math last night just to look at the numbers. When we were talking about the Prop 30 campaign in the fall, and we remind people that that's the income tax temporarily on the most wealthy, the sales tax increase temporarily on everyone. When we were talking Prop 30 during the campaign, it was generally believed to be about a $6 billion a year boost to the state budget, somewhere between $6 and $9 billion. Well, the governor's budget assumes that it will be a little bit larger than that, and in particular, the governor's budget assumes that Prop 30 will actually bring in about $3 billion to the budget year that has already passed. Hmm. Because remember, budget years and tax years are somewhat different, and so the money's going to come in and be accounted to different years. So when you look at these numbers that the governor says there was a surplus in the current year, a small surplus, and that is balanced from the next few years, that is really largely due to those major Prop 30 tax revenues.
John Myers joining us this morning, political editor at KXTV in Sacramento. Let's spend a moment on what that sentence means for the areas we're going to focus on specifically, education and health care. Jill Tucker, as you started reviewing this budget yesterday, how different is it for you looking at this than looking at budgets passed in terms of what that will mean for education?
You know, it's hard to find the right word for it because it's been so long that we've used words like surplus and balanced budget. And I think when school districts started seeing and the education advocates and folks out there started seeing the dollars that would be coming in not only next year but over the next 3 years, I don't know if shocking's the right word or just relieved, all of the above. So it's a completely different story this year.
And are you getting that sense as you've begun to talk to people in the education world? Is there this giant sense of relief and optimism about what the future bodes?
Well, let's just realize we're still California and we still love our politics. So people are using those lovely words like the devil's in the details and let's wait and see, because obviously this is just a proposal and we still have a long way to go through debates and getting to pass a budget, hopefully by the end of June. But yes, districts are, I wouldn't say they're dancing in the halls, but they're definitely relieved and crossing their fingers that the amount of money that the governor is talking about, they're talking about $3,000 on average more per student within the next 3 years. That's just – it's hard to even imagine.
Give before we move to health care, just put that in context for us now. What does that actually mean in terms of the amount of change that represents in terms of per pupil funding?
Well, right now we're at about $6,700 on average per student. It's a little more when you add in federal money and things like that. But we're way down from where we were in 2008. This new budget this next year brings education spending in the state to about $50 billion. But that's still down from almost $57 billion in 2008. But he wants to get closer to $9,000 per student in state spending. It's great news because just the other day when they looked at all the states, California dropped from about 47th in student spending to 49th. So we are really at the bottom. And if we can, over the next few years, education folks are saying, you know, this is really going to boost us up from the basement.
And on the healthcare front, Lisa Alaferes, what's the general take on what this will mean for the kind of health care that will be available, particularly for poor Californians?
So, yes, there were certainly sighs of relief across through state and county and local governments yesterday. But I think the different story is that while there are no additional cuts, nothing is being restored, unlike education, which now has a bigger pool of money to draw from, largely through Prop 30. So while there's relief that there are no additional cuts, there were rallies across the state yesterday arguing to restore things that had been cut. Dental care for poor Californians, for adults, was slashed. Podiatry was slashed. I mean, there are just cuts after cuts after cuts after cuts in health care. And nothing is being restored, but at least the bleeding is stopped, so to speak, for now.
Let's hear a little bit more now on some of the cuts, because while the good news has been something that's commanded most of the headlines, there are concerns out there, and we're going to get one more voice involved in our conversation to speak to that point. Vanessa Aramayo is director of California Partnership, which is a coalition of community-based groups that works to reduce poverty. Vanessa Aramayo, I take it that your take on the overall budget, is not nearly as enthusiastic as we've been hearing.
Right. We think that the governor's proposal really truly lacks the vision that is needed to be able to meet the needs that so many families struggling in California have. It's right, as it was mentioned earlier, there was no mention of restorations to programs. I think we have to think back that the reason why the governor is able to think that we're near a balanced budget this time is because so many families and so many of California's most vulnerable have endured so many cuts over the last few years. Health and Human Services alone since 2008 have seen $15 billion in cuts. And these have been very drastic cuts that folks have had to face in CalWORKs programs, in Medi-Cal, in grant cash increases. People that are, blind, hard of hearing, disabled families, and disabled persons. This has been a very impactful. These have been a very impactful last 2 years and very difficult years for these populations. And this budget that was just introduced lacks the ability to be able to address how we're going to help those families struggling.
And how do you respond? And how do you respond, Lisa, to the governor's general response to that sort of point, Vanessa? That those are all well and good; those are important programs, but we just don't have the money. And he is saying that he's going to embrace the role of being the person who says no.
He needs to embrace the role of being able to rebuild, restore, and reinvest in this state. And he needs to be able to have the vision of revenues that he hasn't been addressing either, additional revenues that can be talked about. Corporate tax loopholes. We're losing billions of dollars every year for simple things like corporations not being able to have their own properties assessed. I mean, there are some very viable solutions that the governor is not considering.
Vanessa Aramayo, the director of California Partnership, bringing to our attention this morning the kinds of concerns that many people do have, even though that largely the budget offers more than recent budgets, there are those concerns that are being cut. Vanessa Aramayo, thanks for adding your perspective. John Meyer, is this now the fight that will go forward on this budget, that there will be pushes from not only groups like California Partnership and others, but also now between Democrats versus Democrats, that there will be a lot of push by Democratic lawmakers now, especially that they have have the supermajority to restore some of these things that, that Governor Brown is saying, sorry, just can't do that.
Well, I think it is the narrative that we'll watch. I mean, I don't think it will begin at breakneck speed. I think you heard the legislative leadership yesterday, Assembly Speaker John Perez, Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg, both congratulate the governor, agree with him. It was a sound plan, a sound starting point, et cetera, et cetera. I will say that I think the governor, the other benefit the governor had to laying out this proclamation that the deficit has disappeared, that the budgets are balanced, is that it gives him, I think, a fairly strong rhetorical starting point, does it not, to say, look, it's in balance. You guys want to do something, you have to take something out. You want this, you got to do that. In other words, you know, I think in several years past, we have had this debate here at the Capitol where we were already in the hole, so what was the problem at adding another $100 million, $200 million, et cetera? Now, you know, the governor has made it very clear that any tinkering is going to have to be accounted for. And I think to the other guest's point a moment ago about those other proposals, I think you're going to start to hear that very soon in the following way. The governor made it clear yesterday, and he was careful to make it clear, that what he's talking about are existing revenues and revenues that we already expect to have. If there is additional money somewhere, well, that's another discussion. And the one way the Democrats are already identifying the idea of additional money is not a tax increase, at least in the way most people think of it, but a reexamination of all the tax credits that are on the books in California. We have somewhere on the magnitude of $50, $60 billion a year that do not come into the state treasury because of tax credits. Now, a lot of them are very popular. We're not talking about we're going to wipe all those out. But the Democrats, I do believe, are going to reexamine tax credits. And with a supermajority status in the legislature, they don't need Republican votes to do that.
In some ways, then, John, is that a parallel debate to what's going on in Washington about the need for tax reform, that making money by way of reforming some of those things is the way that more money will be garnered as opposed to raising rates?
It is, except in the sense that, it is on its surface. I think the one difference is that in Washington, they're kind of still stuck, it seems to me, on something we did in California a few years ago, which was this debate about did it have to be revenue neutral? That is, if you made a change over here that brought in revenue, you did something else that might cost money, and you know, you kind of had a wash. Democrats here, I think, now, because of being a supermajority in the legislature, no longer have to have the pretense of revenue neutral. They can make tax credit changes that actually bring in more money. The great question here is, how does Jerry Brown view those kinds of maneuvers? Does he consider them tax increases himself? Does he have to go back to his pledge of going to the people, or does he go along? And I think that's really what I'll be watching over the next few weeks.
Let's mine further the budget document and what it will mean, both in terms of the amount of money spent, but also the way in which policy will change, particularly, again, in education and health care. Because this budget, Jill Tucker, when it comes to education, not only is giving schools for the first time additional money, but it's also changing the way in which that money is delivered in a pretty significant way. I mean, it's not exactly as significant as something like Prop 13, but it's a big change.
It's a huge change. He's been talking about this for a while. In fact, policymakers have been talking about this for years and years, and no one has figured out a way to make what I call the Winchester mystery system of education funding something that's
staircases
rational.
Staircases that go nowhere?
Exactly. You know, just built upon layer upon layer upon layer of legislation that makes no sense. You can have two school districts that have the exact same population of kids, and they get completely different amounts of money from the state. And what the governor is proposing is a rational system that says if you have the same number of kids who have the same needs, you get the same amount of money. And equalizing that funding has been really tough, though, because in the past it has always meant taking something away from a school district that perhaps gets more money now and giving it to somebody else. And what the governor has done with this new budget is say no one's a loser here. We're not going to take away any money from anyone. Some school districts that have more English learners or low-income kids are going to get a lot more money.
So where does that money come from? If it's not what some states call a Robin Hood system, where rich districts help fund poor districts, if that's not going on? Where does the extra money come from to boost those districts that have a high number of poor kids or English language learners?
Well, number one, he's going to phase it in, so it's not going to happen instantly. But the $2.7 billion that he's adding to the education budget next year would flow more to the schools that have those low-income students and English learners, for example. So they would get more of that piece of pie. The other school districts, you might see some school districts, and they're going to feel like losers, even though they're not going to lose any money. But they're not going to see any more money. They're just not going to see cuts. But they've been getting a lot more than their share for years, according, you know, which is what the governor is saying. So it really is, it'll be phased in. It'll take some years to get to that equal funding. But the idea of completely reforming this and one of the other, the biggest, one of the biggest things that he's doing is local control. He is cutting the strings to virtually all of the funding.
So much of education funding is often categorical. You get this amount of money to do programs in one arena. You get this amount of money for staffing to do X or Y. This means districts are sort of free to, if they want to spend their money on smaller class sizes, they can do that. If they want to spend it on more art programs, they can do that.
Absolutely. What they called categorical funding, I like to describe it, is you can have this money, but only if you buy purple curtains, you know, and it's that whether it's teacher training, books, whatever that money had with special interest and strings attached, they're cutting all of those strings. The only ones that remain, they will fund the money for special education, the money for lunches, and the money for some after-school programs will remain dedicated to that. But otherwise, class size reduction, money for English learners, specific programs, those will no longer – they'll just get the money and then it'll be up to local school districts and local schools to decide how to spend it.
Now, the legislature, John Myers, is yet to weigh in on this. Right. The governor floated this, I think, a good year ago, right? So will this – how will this be greeted at the legislature?
Well, Jill's right. It's been talked about for a while. He began working on it last year. There were several, you know, thoughtful policy discussions. But the reality was last year was a huge political year. The governor had too much on his plate with Prop 30 and everything else, and it just didn't happen. I think that it's realistic that the governor has the political capital and the strength of the public opinion behind him to make changes. I am a little skeptical of how far he can go. For example, one of the very first hotly debated parts of the whole notion of categoricals and mandates from Sacramento is class size reduction. Incredibly popular among parents. Very popular with California Teachers Association, which is the most powerful interest group in California politics. That's not to say that maybe that one remains and the other ones go away, but the CTA put out a statement yesterday that said, you know, good job, Governor, but we have lots of questions. And I think that's the real question here. Jerry Brown has a very strong political alliance after the election with the teachers union. They are a very big player, and I think the sausage making on this is going to be interesting.
But hasn't class size reduction largely already gone away?
Well, there have been all of these temporary holds on it to save money, and as we know now, the maximum proposals that we're talking about have kind of wiggled and waggled around the current law. But, you know, what we're talking about here is a long-term structure, and I think that the more that Brown continues to make this a discussion about long-term fixes, probably the better political footing he's on, because everybody likes to fight the one-year, two-year, three-year battle, not the 10-year battle.
John Myers joining us from Sacramento this morning, where he's political editor at KXTV. We welcome your thoughts on this topic as well. What do you think of what the governor put forward yesterday? What do you make of the changes in education, the changes in this school formula that Jill and John were describing, which will alter the way in which districts get their money? Good idea? What do you think? You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website as well. Let's switch over for a moment to healthcare, Lisa Alaferis, and talk specifically about the expansion of Medi-Cal and what that will mean for poor Californians. And by way of context, let's go back for a moment to the Supreme Court decision last summer and how that impacts what California has chosen to do. Because the Supreme Court, when it said the Affordable Care Act was constitutional, They said this part of it, though, the Medicaid expansion was optional, right? So that, so what's going on now?
Yeah, that's correct. And so the governor yesterday, excuse me, and the Secretary of Health and Human Services confirmed that the state will move ahead with the Medicaid expansion, Medi-Cal in California. This is the health insurance program for the poor and disabled, as you said. And so there was some... I'd say this was widely expected, but nonetheless, it's nice to have the rubber stamp on that, that yes, we are moving ahead with this. The state has been a leader. Their line is the line around the state is we want to be the lead car on the Medicaid expansion. So having said that, though, there are multiple ways the state can there are two different approaches specifically the state wants to do. The secretary said that they had considered multiple different paths and settled on two. One would be a pretty simple expansion at the state level, expansion of the Medi-Cal program. The other would be leaving it to the counties. So 55 of 58 counties have already begun the Medi-Cal expansion, or they've done a bridge to reform. It's called the low-income health program. So getting people into health care so that they'll be ready January 1st, 2014 to transition to Medi-Cal. And so the state is saying, well, either the state continue to run the program or the counties can run the program. And this is predicated upon what Diana Dooley, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, said yesterday, a conversation that begins immediately between the state and the counties, because this the funding of these new Medi-Cal recipients will be borne 100% by the federal government.
And we'll pick up more on this after our short break. But but John Myers, just one comment from you on this. It reminds me a bit of what happened with prisons, about sort of getting more prisoners down to the county level as a way to the state to save money. Is that sort of how this is being viewed in Sacramento?
I certainly see it a parallel there, Dave, because, I mean, you know, and Brown loves to talk about it in his Jesuit upbringing terms, the principle of subsidiarity, you know, the best government's that's closest to the people. And Jerry Brown, as a former mayor, I think really saw government differently through that experience than he did when he was governor before. And I think he has continually pushed about letting people make their own decisions. That's part of the education part. That's part of this. And I think it was part of realignment in 2011.
And briefly, Lisa, before we go to our break, what consequence does this have then for poor Californians? How many more people will actually be able to get health care that aren't getting it today?
Well, that's a good question. There's the estimates are there are 1.4 million Californians that could benefit by this expansion. They will become newly eligible, but how many of those people will actually enroll is there are wide differentials. And there's another population who will come into the state system as well, which we can get into a little more after the break if you'd like.
We will take that short break and come back and take your calls. What do you make of Governor Jerry Brown's new budget, what he is proposing in terms of Medi-Cal expansion, and health care for poor Californians, and also on education, what he's doing in terms of providing more money for schools, but also delivering that money in a new way? We'll also get into what the budget has to say about the University of California and the California State University systems as well. You can join our conversation now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your comments, questions, or thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website as well. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the California state budget, which for the first time in many a moon has more good news than bad. The governor announcing yesterday that the state's budget for the foreseeable future would be balanced. Joining us to talk about what's inside that budget, John Myers, political editor at KXTV in Sacramento, Jill Tucker, education writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Lisa Alaferos, the health editor for KQED News and the editor of our State of Health blog. Lisa, before the break, we were talking a little bit about this two paths that that may be followed now in terms of the expansion of Medi-Cal. Where will this fight play out, and how big a fight will that be between Sacramento versus the 50-some counties?
So it is the secretary did say that it is a conversation that will happen to determine, you know, the state is not going to make a decision unilaterally. It'll be done in conversation with the counties. But the secretary signaled that because of this additional influx of federal money, that the that there should be appropriate sharing, was the term she used, between the states and the counties. And so I spoke this morning with Alex Briscoe. He's the director of the Alameda County Healthcare Services Agency. And he said that that kind of a statement presupposes that current state funding to the counties is sufficient to meet the needs of caring for these indigent adults. So in other words, okay, well, now you're getting money from the feds, so the state can take back its funding that it's that it's been giving. And he called that, quote, simply preposterous. That he said there, that almost no county in California under current funding can meet the needs of its indigent Californians. So there's going to be I think there will be a quite a vigorous discussion at the very least around this issue. The state suggested that if it continued to run the Medi-Cal program, that maybe they would want the counties then to pick up something they are already doing. And one of the things they – one of the areas they mentioned was child care, that maybe counties should be responsible for all child care, subsidized child care. So –
so I'm wondering now about when we talk – one word that often comes up in these budget discussions, John Myers, is structural, you know, budgets and structural reform. And are we now structurally sound, I guess, is my question. We talk about how there will be federal money that will help us with expanding Medi-Cal, and we've got this new sales tax and temporary tax increase on upper-income people. But that sort of settles things out for a while, right? I mean, but the clock ticks on that. So are we really structurally sound now?
I don't think there's any more structural stability than there was before. I think you're right, Dave, because you hit it right there. The taxes that allow the governor to proclaim the end of the deficits do expire after a certain number of years, the sales tax and the income tax on the most wealthy. Now, that's not to say that other things won't happen while that is going on. I've long suspected that what the governor really was trying to do when he came into office was find a way to get the state to the next economic recovery. And when the economy recovered, by extension, a lot of the deficit pressures would go away. But we have not dealt with a lot of other questions about the way we, for instance, the tax structure. We've been talking about tax reform for the last several years. There was a Blue Ribbon Commission whose report promptly collected lots of dust on the shelf of the legislature. There have been other discussions about the local-state relationship. Yes, the governor began that discussion, but it never really finished. So, no, I think there's a vast amount of room for structural reform. I think the real question is, what does Jerry Brown want to focus on? I mean, he realizes that the bandwidth of the public and the legislature is relatively small. And what does he want to focus on? He's tackling schools first. I think that's probably a smart one politically and policy-wise. Should he win a second term, maybe he'll want to go beyond that. But I think at this point, we are kind of the same structure of government we've always had, which means we rely on income taxes. By the way, we're going to rely on income taxes more than we ever have before, because part of that realignment program sent more of the state's portion of sales taxes to counties to administer social programs and public safety programs. So, no, we've got a lot of room for a discussion on reform.
I want to come back, if there's time, to the question of whether Jerry Brown in the future and the whole question of a second term, because that's fascinating in its own right. And because, as he said the other day, I'll be 75 in April, and I didn't come here to screw around. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes. But let's get to our listener calls first, and then we'll recycle back to Jerry Brown's future. Jamie joins us first in Fairfax. Jamie, go ahead, please.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to hear everybody's thoughts on the debt overhang that we have. So, you know, it sounds debatable that we have a budget that's going to be balanced this year, but we've got this tremendous amount of money that we still owe. The focus of the conversation seems to be on where we can increase spending to restore things that have been cut. So how does that factor into the equation, and, you know, when are we going to get our bond rating back up?
Jamie, thanks for the call. John, you want to take a swing at that, please?
Sure. Well, first of all, on the bond rating has gone back up. I mean, we dipped down to be pretty abysmal. We're not the best state in the country by any means yet, but the bond ratings have come back up. The the credit rating agencies do seem to think we're on a better track. There are two different kinds of debt I think we should really think about when we think about the way government has incurred debt over the last few years. One of them is shorter term, and one of them is longer term. The shorter term is what I think Jerry Brown typically refers to as the wall of debt. He estimated that at the end of 2011, that was about a $35 billion debt burden on the state, and that included everything like deferred payments during the recession to particular things, schools and other things. It also included those deficit bonds that Arnold Schwarzenegger convinced the voters to approve back in 2004. The governor's budget assumes that $35 billion wall of debt by the summer of 2017 will have shrunk to about $4 billion. And so he is has remained consistent about saying he wants to pay off that. That I would call short-term debt. But to the caller's point, and I think maybe the caller is kind of thinking this, there are debts that are not addressed in this budget, and probably the one that is going to get talked about the most, and I had one of the people email me this morning while I was at the coffee shop getting a cup of coffee, is public employee pensions,
yep.
Is the unfunded liability of pensions. And how you calculate that is a bit of a debatable point, but there is not a lot of money in this budget for dealing with some of those costs, most notably the cost that the state is going to face for the teachers' pension fund, CalSTRS, which is projected to run out of money in the next few decades unless the state takes action. So the caller's right. There is more work to do on the issue of debt.
And Jerry Brown's also been consistent, John, about saying, look, a deal is a deal. We made these pension arrangements. We can't change them. We can change them for future employees, but we can't change them for the people who are already in the system.
Well, he has said that, but I think he has also given a nod to really what the great question is about the pension debate, not that we're having a discussion on pensions completely this hour, and that is, can you rework the deals for the deals for existing state employees, deals that they were promised maybe 3, 4, 5, 10 years ago, and I shouldn't say state employees, state and local employees. And the only way you can have that discussion is to take it to the courts.
Yep.
There's a lot of legal precedent there, and someone would have to do it. Jerry Brown has not seemed to have a taste for challenging the pension system in the courts.
Jamie, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Jackie next in San Francisco. Jackie, go ahead, please.
Hi, I work for the UC system. I will not say which branch because I'm an adjunct. And I just got back from the Modern Languages Association, which is the largest humanities conference of its kind in the world. And I've had to explain over and over again, oh, you guys are great, California, you guys are going to be fine. No, the proposition keeps the lights on. And speaking as an adjunct, we are the new majority, as we're referred to. I make below what folks make at McDonald's. And if I didn't have a partner with a job, I would not be able to keep this certain job. I actually would have to go work at Starbucks or McDonald's. And I got a PhD for this. And this is what's normal for 71% of all instructors in America. Do we have any kind of future for the University of California or Cal State system to actually employ professors again at full time, rather than one professor per department working their butts off, and a bunch of other people working below minimum wage, working their butts off, who have no.
Jackie, thanks. Yeah, no, I hear your pain and your anxiety. Adjuncts, of course, are temporary, aren't tenure track professorships. Jackie is in that situation. Jill Tucker, what can you say about what the UC budget got? They got a little bit more money, but what's the future look like for the UCs and for people who are in positions like Jackie's?
Well, I think the CSU and UC systems got about $250 million more each. Given the cuts that they faced over the last several years, more money is good. It's not as much as they wanted. It's not enough to restore funding to even close to where they were several years ago. The governor's budget really does focus on K-12, K-14, which would include community colleges. And he gives a nod to the UC and CSU system and acknowledges how important they are and that they need to be built back up. But it's not going to happen immediately. So they're getting more money. It's going to be up to the UC and CSU system if this budget passes to decide where they want that money to go. I think the governor's been pretty strong about not raising student fees anymore and restoring some of the things that are going on. He also builds in reforms, just like K-12, just like with healthcare and other things. He's building in reforms with this money that they're getting. It's not going to address the caller's adjunct status in the short term, but I think ultimately what he's trying to do in terms of he wants to see, for example, the number of credits capped that a student can have. So you're not going to see these eight-year undergrads just getting the state subsidy for higher ed year after year after year. He wants to cap that so that more students can come in and use that subsidy.
The idea behind that is that if students move through the UCs or the CSUs more promptly, then because each student is in effect subsidized by the state, if they get through more quickly, there's room for the next group of students.
We can serve more students if other students are getting out of the way.
But to Jackie's concern, doesn't sound like the budget holds anything for a great increase in the number of English professors hired at UC Santa Barbara or wherever.
You know, I haven't seen any of that in the discussions. It is super early. And I, like I said, with K-12 and with higher ed, the governor is saying, here's the amount of money. It's all about local control. So how they're going to distribute that, I don't think it's enough to really help out that level immediately. But certainly it's not cut and it is more money.
Jackie, thanks for the call. Best of luck to you. Lisa Alaferis, in terms of growth of state employees in the healthcare arena, do we know what this will mean? I mean, if being an English adjunct professor is not a growth industry at the moment, is there within the healthcare world, will there be more people because of the Medi-Cal expansion?
Well, healthcare is definitely a growth industry that is with – and the expectation is that with this influx of federal money and with the requirement starting January 1st, 2014, that everyone have health insurance, that there will be – many additional jobs. There will be greater job opportunity within healthcare across multiple levels.
And to Nathan, next in Oakland this morning. Nathan, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. So I've been a teacher for about 10 years, and I've taught at Berkeley Unified and West Contra Costa Unified, which is Richmond, and also Oakland most recently, as well as some charter schools. And I've seen a lot of different implementations of budgets and things like that, and I'm wondering about with Governor Brown's proposal, how that's going to look. A lot of school sites, especially in the low-income schools, which is primarily what I've worked in, some of them have site-based budgeting where principals and a group of staff make decisions on how budget is allocated, where others, the district is told how they're supposed to spend their budget and they have to implement it accordingly. I've also noticed that most of the low-income school districts in low-income schools that have site-based budgeting, some of them aren't very wise about where they put their money, and they end up kind of squandering it. I'm wondering what the oversight is going to look like by way of the governor's proposal in order to make sure that schools are spending the money appropriately in the right places, because a lot of times they're just spinning their wheels. They're not really making improvements.
Great question, Nathan. Thank you. Jill?
It is a great question, Nathan. And I'm already hearing from folks in the education community about the accountability in a system where the money flows to the locals with no strings attached. And there are a bunch of folks out there questioning, well, how do we make sure that that money follows the kids? I mean, if it's just getting dumped into the district's bank account, you know, how do we make sure that that money is flowing to every one of those English learners or low-income kids and not just getting spread across in raises or other types of things that aren't resulting in specific help for those students? I think it is going to we'll have to see. The governor's proposal in terms of having this local control would require a massive overhaul of the education code. Many, many, many laws govern how we spend our money.
And is there anything in the budget, John Myers, about Nathan's specific question about accountability? Will there be any oversight, or are districts literally free to sort of go down whatever path they choose?
I haven't seen anything that addresses his particular question, and I think this, you know, is part of what we have been talking about here, but maybe we should remind folks. You know, the governor, by law, is required to introduce a budget no later than January 10th. From there, it's the legislature's baby, and then we come back and we revise it in May, and then we put it into law in June, early July. And I think that you're going to see, especially because he has put such a focus on this reworking in some way, shape, or form of public education in California, you're going to see an awful lot of debate about these very specific kinds of issues in the legislature in the next few weeks or months. And I think, so my two questions are, how much of this is shaped by the legislature and interest groups, and how much of this is shaped by the bully pulpit of the governor? I mean, you know, he does have the largest microphone in the state. He has already indicated on higher education that he's going to use that bully pulpit. He's going to go to the regents and the trustees and give them a grief about not increasing tuition. But back on K through 12 schools, the question is how much of this the governor gets out and tries to sell people and listen to communities and make his case.
And John, on that point, while we're on the governor for a moment, let me ask you my political question, which is that it seems like Jerry Brown recently has been sort of channeling his inner Chris Christie, you know, and really been very feisty in the way in which he has approached this particular question of where money will go. Do you see him being that aggressive going forward?
I'd try to imagine him channeling Chris Christie, given how much they sparred with each other in the summer over issues,
right.
And he challenged him to a foot race. You know, I think that Brown, he has famously said, at this stage of my life, I'm not here to delay or deny, or as you said the other day, he said, I'm not here to screw around. It'll be 75 in April. The governor gives every indication that he's in this for another term. And as long as he gives that indication, of course, it keeps his political strength up and it keeps all of the wannabe Democrats at bay. But, you know, the governor ran for this job, again, primarily to fix the state's problems. I think he is keenly aware of that as maybe a part of his legacy, that he can do something different than the first time he was governor. Can he fix them in one term? What happens? I think this year is a really fascinating year on the Jerry Brown story, because now that he's got the wolves somewhat at bay of the finances, does he have the breathing room to make some changes? And then what does he tell the voters is his vision for the future after that come 2014? So this is the year to watch. I think it'll be fun to watch.
And back to our calls. Bonnie is next in Oakland. Bonnie, you're on.
Yes, I'm wondering about special education money that the school district pays out and that it's earmarked, and how it seems like special education programs are shrinking, are being cut. And I know that's not because, I mean, there are less children who need special education. My son attends a school in which next year they're going to have to cut down one classroom and cut staff because the school district isn't paying out the money that parents need to send their child to a school that meets the child's needs.
Let's see if we can get an answer to that. This is the one categorical funding that remains. So what's happening? Is there more money for special ed, or is it just being sort of held to what it currently is?
You know, there is more money, and there are some reforms about how special education is funded. But the reality is with special education, even though there have been some cuts during the recession, there are very specific laws about funding special education and serving these students. And while there, as I said, there have been cuts. In general, most of these programs are still intact. It's the state money will still flow specifically for that. No one can touch it. The federal money that flows, nobody can touch that. And the district is obligated to serve those students. I think we are seeing, you know, parents are seeing some cuts here and there and are feeling it with their students. But ultimately, it is one of the most protected programs in public education.
Bonnie, thanks for the call. 866-733-6786 is our number if you'd still like to join us. 866-733-6786. If you have a thought, concern, question about the state budget, we have three guests who can answer those questions. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts or questions on our Facebook page. Jeff writes in, can you explain again how California public schools get funded and how we can elevate our position from 49th in the country? I don't want to go into a long kind of funding of schools 101, Jill Tucker, but what are the prospects on the question of if we're now 49th and if we add 3,000 more per pupil over the next several years, do we get to like 40th? I mean, where will we be?
Yeah, I will say, I'm almost laughing when he said, please explain the education system, because there are truly only about five people in the state that understand it. But ultimately, I don't know where this will put us. It will raise us up. Of course, the entire country's coming out of a recession, so one would assume that all states are going to be spending more on education. I think if they put $3,000 in it, we aren't going to be 49th anymore. I don't want to hazard a guess as to where we'll be. But ultimately, the state does have Prop 98, which ensures that about 40% of our budget in the state is spent on education. And, you know, I think I think that this new budget and how we're focusing money in Prop 30 is going to dig us out of the very bottom.
And in terms of healthcare prospects and increasing the number of people who will walk us through to some extent, if you would, Lisa, how everything will change once that mandate goes into effect mm-hmm. and the new healthcare mm-hmm. exchanges. How big will that be in terms of more state employees? Number of emails here concerned about sort of waste and inefficiency mm-hmm. and the number of state employees. Mm-hmm. What outline for us what's ahead? Because that's a huge change that's just now very less than a year away.
Yes, we need to move. The state needs to move with all deliberate speed. January 1st, starting in October, the exchange will open for business. And this is a place where individuals and small businesses can purchase insurance. And individuals will receive subsidies from the federal government. And the exchange needs to be self-supporting. So that is not a state-run bureaucracy. That is something which needs to pay for itself. And at the same time, the publicity around and the marketing efforts by the exchange to get people to purchase, these are private insurance plans that they will purchase on an exchange. So this is not a government-run program. This is private insurance, and it's just a marketplace. But the estimates are that many people will enroll, but those estimates vary quite – nobody can say exactly how many people will. So there's the people who will purchase in the exchange, and then there's the Medicaid expansion.
And the interesting thing to me about the huge Medicaid expansion is that the better the job that is done as far as marketing goes, the more money will need to be spent and potentially the bigger liability for the state, right?
No, not exactly. Because the federal match, just speaking of Medicaid, the federal match is 100% until 2016. So the federal government is picking up 100% of the tab, and then it'll drift down to 90% over the next by 2020. So there's a huge push to get as many people enrolled as soon as possible to get the full effect of those federal dollars.
Back to our calls. William joins us next in Belvedere. William, you're on.
Yes, thank you. I'm intrigued not just by what's being said, which is very interesting, but also what isn't being said. What I've heard is that the Democrats do control, they have a supermajority. Also, that although there is more money now, there is not enough money to replace money that used to be, particularly with respect to medical and social expenses. And what I haven't heard discussed is whatever happened to the concept of the oil severance tax, which would have gone a long way, and which is in all the other states where they have oil drilling. And what it makes me wonder is whether, particularly since the Democrats have a supermajority now, whether it is true that the oil company interests are very influential in the Democratic Party as well as in the Republican Party.
Let's get a take on that from John Myers. John?
Well, I think there are two things to say to the caller quickly. The first one is that all tax measures, all tax ideas still have to go through the governor for passage, either enactment into law or if they wanted to put them on the ballot. The governor has had this definition that I referenced earlier about no new taxes without a vote of the people, and we have to figure out exactly what he means by a new tax. An oil severance tax certainly would seem to be a new tax, but it remains to be seen how that would play out. One of the reasons an oil severance tax hasn't ever happened is because it's thought it would trigger a very large political fight of one way or the other. The oil companies have a lot of money. It's the same kind of fight, frankly. I almost can't believe it, Dave. We've gone through a budget show without talking about Prop 13.
But go ahead.
One time. It's the same kind of fight that people worry would be triggered if we talked about a reworking of Prop 13, where commercial properties would be taxed differently than residential properties. These are huge political battles. The caller makes a great point. Democrats do have friends in the oil business, too. It's not all Republicans. But these are big political fights, and the question is, does the governor or someone really have the stomach for them, and do they think the voters are with them?
William, thanks for the call. Lisa.
I just wanted to clarify, Dave, you actually were, we were both right. With the Medicaid expansion, the people who are newly eligible will be 100% covered by the federal government, but it's also expected that many tens of thousands of people who are currently eligible but not enrolled, the state will pay half the tab for them, and that's where the state is concerned about how much that could cost them. So we were both right.
Great. We just have a moment left. So a quick thought from each of you about what you find the most intriguing about this budget. Lots of good and interesting news, but Jill Tucker, as you look at it, what to you perks your interest the most?
You know, in terms of education, building in this reform in terms of changing completely how we fund schools is huge. It isn't just taking it on separately when people are bored, but doing it within the budget. If he pulls this off, it would be a dramatic change.
Lisa.
And no cuts to health care. That's a dramatic change. But also this state versus county, how the rollout of Medi-Cal is going to happen, the expansion, that's going to be huge.
And John, a last quick thought, since you're on the Jerry Brown watch.
I was going to take it from the governor's perspective. I'm fascinated by how much credit the governor seems to be getting for this budget and doing the right thing. I think that is in large part because he went and dealt with the tax issue. That is a traditional way you balance budgets, by getting more revenues. But it gave him the freedom to be optimistic. I mean, Arnold Schwarzenegger was optimistic, but a lot of the budgets had lots of gimmicks in them. And he is optimistic about the future. He thinks unemployment's going down. He thinks other things will happen. And also, too, the credit he's getting for a budget that doesn't really add a lot of extra money anywhere except for education. Calling that a great budget is a remarkable feat.
John Myers, political editor at KXTV, but always known to us as the former Sacramento Bureau Chief for KQED. John, thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave.
Jill Tucker has been with us as well, education writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Jill, thanks as always.
Oh, thank you.
And Lisa Alaferis, health editor for KQED News and editor of the State of Health blog. Lisa, thank you.
Good to be here.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. Danny Bringer, our engineer. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.